Okay, we'll come back together for our last public item today, which is the 2021 legislative concepts step.
Thanks.
Todd?
Yeah. Thanks again, Chair Imason. I think I have to say again for the record, Chad Davis, Director of Partnership and Planning Program, and apparently I'm the process guy today. I'm back before you with a draft topic or a legislative concept topic that is draft, and again, you will be sought approval of legislative concepts if the department moves forward into the process in March. This is the first viewing and airing of them in this type of setting. Again, we did talk about these kind of more generally at the October retreat. The legislative concepts for February 2021, not February 2020, so yes, almost a year ahead. It's amazing to me, and I think to a lot of the folks around here, how fast this comes at us again after we just feel like sometimes we just finished the previous session. We have, I've described them as kind of one and a half legislative concepts in the package. I'll talk about the one in particular, and then you've already heard a little bit of discussion around different tools around Board of Forestry lands, and Brian's here to kind of talk about the other ideas that are also in the packet as they relate particularly to State Forest Program and the Board of Forestry lands. The primary one that is, again, for those of you that are going through this for the first time, is a biennial bill that we carry, we introduce, or we seek to get introduced every year, is the Forest Products Harvest Tax Bill. That is a bill that establishes the privilege tax per 1,000 board feet on the harvesting of timber. Then there are roughly five recipients of that tax, and it is defined, and four of those are defined in statute what the actual rate is. Two of those recipients are accounts here at the Department of Forestry. Two of them are at Oregon State University. Then the fifth recipient is the Oregon Forest Resource Institute. The rate for OFRI is not set by the legislature through this bill process, but the funding for OFRI does come through the Forest Products Harvest Tax. The two specific that come to the Department of Forestry, one of the rates changes every biennium, and that is the rate that funds 40% of the implementation of the Forest Practices Act within the Private Forest Division. There's also a contribution from the harvest tax that goes to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and that rate is set in statute and doesn't change. The bill that we generally work through the governor's office and eventually through legislative council goes in with blanks in the rates. It's kind of an interesting concept, and we have to explain it a lot of times to different legislative staff. Why has this got a blank in it? It's really a complicated process that the department's involved in terms of setting that rate at the kind of the tail end of session around what the forecasted timber harvest is going to be over the next 2 years, in conjunction with what the legislature is allocating to implement the Forest Practices Act. It's kind of, and then the rate is basically a quick, a simple, from there, it's a simple math equation to fill 40% of the implementation of the Forest Practices Act. That particular rate, and I believe both at OSU, also sunset every biennium. The bill does two things. It changes the rate, but it also effectively extends the tax or reinstitutes the tax. Without this bill, that tax would go away if we don't carry it. Not just that the rate would change, that the actual tax would go away relative to funding implementation of the forest products. Sorry, the FPA. It's really a bill that's most of primary importance to the Private Forest Division. However, it's a big chunk of the department's budget as well, a critical function. I've been around for a few enough sessions now, they let me actually talk about it, where generally we like to have the divisions up here talking about their particular policy pieces. Any questions on the Forest Products Harvest Tax? Okay. I think I'll turn it over to Brian to talk about the state forest pieces that are in the staff report.
Yeah, thanks, Chad. Members of the board, Brian Pugh, I serve as the policy deputy for the State Forest Division. And while Chad's talking about a tax bill, and tax bills aren't controversial in Oregon, I'm talking about a land bill and a concept we have here. And a little bit of background of why we're moving forward on legislative concepts is for several years now, we've been working on business improvements in state forests to be more efficient and effective and recognize kind of the modern times of forestry that we're in. And we've done many things in that categories. Along the way, we've done a couple of legislative concepts that turned into law because we needed more legal authority. And so the most recent ones were clarifying our contracting authorities, and what that did is allow us to sell timber in different ways than we had in the past, and we got that in the 2015 session, I believe, which was a good business change. The other business change we did, a legislative concept that we brought between for this board and then moved into the legislative session was successful, was on big commercial events on state forest, and what we were doing there was trying to stop raves and other illegal parties and keggers on state forest. So it was more of a public safety thing that we did, but it was really good business for us and has helped curb that problem. So this one's been in the queue for a while, but we've paused on it just because of other workloads, and we're bringing it forward now. And really what it is around expanding our authorities on selling and trading and transferring lands. And current authorities, for background, is we have the ability to do land trades and trade lands. And that has served us well in the past. In the 70s and 80s, there was lots of federal and private partners that were willing to trade. But in recent times, it's been really difficult to find willing partners to trade lands with on the large scale. So when you think about what we're talking about here, we're talking about a very small percentage of our landscape. And where we have isolated parcels or we have interior parcels that we do not own. And some of those interior parcels are owned by the Department of State Lands, and we manage them now. We can't always know that we're going to manage them into the future. We saw that on the Elliott. And so one way that these tools could help us is to get more ownership, to make sure we have the right access, to make sure we have maintain the kind of interior conservation habitat that we have. And really just we would be looking to divest of smaller isolated parcels that don't add a lot of value in the terms of greatest permanent value. So when we think about those authorities, and then in 2009, when we purchased the Gilcrest, we did get the authority to sell lands, anything we had acquired after 2009. And so as you may recall, this board did authorize a sale of a piece of the Gilcrest to the Crescent Sanitation District. And that was clearly a good community investment, a good environmental investment, and we had that ability to do it, which is really good. But it was really unique, and since the Gilcrest is the only place we have the authority to sell lands right now. So thinking on that whole context and thinking about our future, we do want to move forward on a concept that gives us more tools, and some of those tools we want to consider and vet and talk with the counties about and work with all stakeholders to get input in is around conservation easements and the ability to have those on our lands. And we do have a conservation easement on about 3,000 acres of land on the Gilcrest. We bought those lands with the conservation easement on there, so we know we can manage lands with conservation easement, but we don't have the authority to do that on our other lands. Another one would be to sell those isolated parcels, sell some small parcels with the ability to buy. The idea we would buy other parcels with it. So that would be that. And then the transfer idea where we would transfer the mandate there to something other than greatest permanent value and still be able to manage the land as the Department of Forestry, or to be able to transfer the lands to another local entity, maybe a tribe, maybe a community forest, a county forest, or another state agency. And so those are the wide range of concepts we're thinking about. As Chad said, you know, we sit here today in January of 2020, and this would be in the 21 session. Thank you. So we have a lot of time to think and work on that and, you know, get some ideas and put them forward and draft them. But that's at this time what we've got is kind of that broad scoping and those additional tools so we can kind of optimize the management of that But it is important to remember, we're talking about a very small percentage of the landscape that we were trying to work on. With that, I'll take questions or comments.
Yeah, Brian, the kind of flexibility seems positive, although, and you talk about small parcels, but when you begin to talk about conservation easements, you could begin to start talking about larger. I mean, how would that align with the HCP? Have you thought through that? How that might, with the HCP process and so on?
Yes, we have, and we've talked with our experts that have testified before you about how that works. And one of the things about the conservation easement, because we have one on the Gilcrest, I just want to clarify, it would still be in the context of greatest permanent value. And so as an example, the one on the Gilcrest is 3,000 acres out of the tens of thousands that we have over there, and it provides conservation there in line with greatest permanent value. And we can still harvest on those parcels on the Gilcrest with the conservation easement on there. So I want to be really clear when we talk about conservation easements, it's still under the greatest permanent value mandate. Specific to the good question around the habitat conservation plan, essentially, if we go forward and get that agreement with the services, we are putting a lot of property into conservation already. So a conservation easement coupled with an HCP would only be purchasing, if you will, the timber rights on the harvestable acres. And so it would purchase essentially the timber rights, not the other areas that we've already committed to conservation under the HCP. And in that appraisal process, we would definitely, again, my thinking would be we would get current and future values of timber harvest on those acres. And again, we'd want to be talking with the counties about it, but clearly we have a mandate to distribute revenues to the counties, and so they would take the majority share as they do off of timber sales is how I'm thinking about it now.
I just encourage you to continue dialogue with the counties in this. Obviously, it's very important to them. I just encourage that, Brian, to continue that dialogue.
Thank you.
And we do have some public testimony also for this round. So other questions or comments?
Brian, as somebody who manages a ranch that's a checkerboard of BLM and private land, I understand the advantages of blocking things up. Of course, the devil will always be in the details. But can you tell us really quickly, you said that the trading program used to work and it no longer works well. Can you explain why?
Yeah, and this is kind of my experience of being in the industry for about 20 years is that historically the federal land managers had a more active trading program, and so the Forest Service, the BLM, it was easier to trade with, and they were actively managing, and that worked better, and they have changed their focus and not been as willing of partners on there, and so that's one side of the equation. Then on the other side, on the private industry side, with the kind of business model change to REITs and TIMOs, they're more, I'd say, efficient and nimble and less willing to go through a 2 or 3 year process on a land trade, because it is a long process to go through a land trade with appraisals, and I think there's 12 steps. And so those are the two things there.
Other comments? Thank you, and stick around in case we need to call you back.
That's right.
Commissioner Yamamoto. So thank you for the second opportunity to address you today. I know most of you are probably tired of hearing from me, but I just wanted to make another comment here and reiterate how important we feel it is to be able to work with the department, to work with the environmental groups, to work with the forestry industry. And the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties would be extremely willing to try to come to an agreement on how we can put together this type of a proposal for the department to come up with a land transfer concept. The current LC64 that you have seen to us is very problematical. And again, we had an agreement where we thought we were going to move forward on a work group, and that didn't happen. But we really would like to put together a work group and work with all parties involved. We feel we could come to an agreement on something that would work for everyone. And we feel that's an important way to move forward here. So unless you have any questions. Well, let me just ask Brian, is that part of the process that you're describing as well?
See, Brian, I told you you shouldn't have left.
We like sitting next to each other.
There you go. Okay.
That's good. So the LC, I got to look at my notes. LC.
Well, I think Commissioner is talking about
looking forward.
The 2020 short session.
2021 short session and working with the department, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, we had the, Liz and I and the other division staff had this legislative concept that we wanted to bring for you, to you and have this discussion today, and then set it up for the 21 session. Along the way, things happen, and we found out early in November that in the short session, a forced transfer bill that had previously been seen in 2019 was coming very quickly. And so after hearing at the October retreat that there was support from the board to work on a transfer concept, we have been collaborating on that transfer bill, and we do still expect to see it in the short session. I know when I heard about it kind of as a rumor, I reached out to the FTLAC and said, here are the rumor, and we've worked collaboratively with the drafters of that bill to get some kind of technical and conceptual changes in there. But we are not, you know, as a department leading that bill, and we've been trying to collaborate on it to get it as good as possible if it does move forward for us.
But the process, I guess my question is, what happens in 2020 is coming up soon. But the process you described of, you know, collaboration and the process that Commissioner Yamamoto also discussed seem fairly compatible, and I guess I'm just confirming that if this is headed to 2021, that the process that you are describing and reaching out to the various partners and stakeholders will continue.
Absolutely, it'll continue, and it will be affected by what happens in the short session for sure. And what I'm trying to clarify is that process for 21, what we're talking to you about today, is in control of the department, right, the board and stuff. And what is not in our control, but we are trying to influence, is that bill in the short session.
Right. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much again for your time.
All right. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us today, the staff, the board, and the members of the public and FTLAC who participated. The board now will have an executive session pursuant to ORS 192-6602-I for the purpose of reviewing the state enforcer's annual performance. No decision will be made, and the meeting will adjourn upon its conclusion. So we'll back over to this room.
Short break.
Yeah, let's take a short break. Look, and we've noticed it at 4 o'clock, so we should probably do it at 4 o'clock. Yeah.